To Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie.
Born in the 16th century, Nostradamus has become one of the world's most widely known and read prophets. His poetic yet cryptic quatrains are claimed by some to conceal information about future events. He completed a total of 942 quatrains, which he organized into centuries, groups of 100 quatrains. One century only had 42 quatrains. Do these writings actually predict the death of popes, the rise of tyrants, and natural catastrophes to come? In a moment, an expert, the secrets of Nostradamus, David Overson, on Coast to Coast AM. David Overson teaches astrology and has studied the prophecies of Nostradamus for more than 40 years. His previous books include The Secrets of Nostradamus and The Secret Architecture of Our Nation's Capital. He also wrote the book The Secret Symbols of the Dollar Bill. We had him on in December. He's an expert on arcane symbolism found on the dollar bill and is able to share the fascinating secret meanings behind the design of the money that we use every day. Our guest tonight on Coast to Coast, David Overson. Hi, David. Welcome back.
Well, very nice to speak with you again, George.
You too. My pleasure indeed. Nostradamus, always a fascination with him. Somehow there seems to be a lot of interest in Nostradamus nowadays. Why is that?
I think there's been an interest in Nostradamus for the past 500 years, actually. Well, 450 years. Yes. He's been one of the outstanding figures in our age.
Why did he prophesize? Why did he write quatrains? What happened to him?
Well, I didn't think anything happened to him. He, in a letter he wrote to the King of France, Henry II, he said that he had his visions from God, and that his knowledge of astrology, which was one of the ways he framed these quatrains, had come to him from his ancestors. He was a second-generation, forcibly converted Jew. So he had in his blood, so to speak, a great deal of the Kabbalistic knowledge, the secret knowledge of the ancient Jews.
The quatrains that he wrote, why wasn't he more direct, David? Why didn't he just spell it right out and say, you know, I believe that this is an Antichrist or this and that? He seemed to hide things.
Well, there are lots of reasons why he should have hidden things. The main reason is one that we tend to overlook nowadays, and that is in the 16th century, one of the most powerful business organizations was the Inquisition. And if he'd openly made predictions, if he'd openly made clear what he knew, he would almost certainly have been
heresy.
Well, he would have been burned, I would have thought. Yeah.
Probably. Let's go back into his early days, his childhood.
Yes.
Tell me about his family.
Well, as I've said, he was second-generation Jewish. In those days, there were lots of pogroms in the south of France, in France as a whole, and there was a time when one had to convert or be expelled, and his family decided to convert to Catholicism rather than be expelled yet again. He was born into this family in a town called Saint-Rémy. In fact, Saint-Rémy has since become quite famous as a place where Van Gogh lived and where he was put in a mental institution. He was born there in 1503. A rather curious year in many ways, 1503. It's very easy to remember because it was sometimes called the year of the three popes and the year of the three stars. Because in 1503 you had a gathering, a very rare gathering of Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn in Cancer, And of course, this was in Nostradamus's horoscope. And you had, because one of the popes died within a few days, you actually had three popes also in 1503, the last one being Julius II,
and which was dramatically, which was dramatically not common. Not in those days, not in these days. Mm-hmm. Most popes last a very long time.
That's right, yes. Well, not necessarily for a long time. I mean, Julius II, who was the last of these three, lasted for 10 years, and during that time he was able to persuade Michelangelo to paint the Sistine Chapel and so on and so forth and do lots of wonderful statuary. So on the whole, it was quite a good period for art, if not for, for local wars and plague, because plague was spreading through France pretty badly in those days.
Was the young Nostradamus, David, particularly gifted?
We don't know. No, I should think nothing at all about his early years. I've researched them fairly carefully, and I haven't really come across anything other than the sort of the inventions of what I call the pseudo-Nostradamians, you know, the people who invent things and call it history. The earliest serious records we have, or at least the earliest written record we have, is when he attended Montpellier University. To study medicine. He trained initially as a doctor, but before he'd worked as a doctor, or even before he trained as a doctor, he'd worked as an apothecary, using herbs and various medicaments, almost as important in those days as a doctor.
Was that his field then? Did he become a doctor?
Yes, he did. He practiced for many years. In fact, he practiced until the end of his life. He eventually settled down in a town called Salon, which is still an extremely beautiful town, an old walled city, and he lived within the walls. He bought a house there, and that house has survived and is now a Nostradamus museum. And in that house, he practiced medicine and astrology, which was his two main sources of income, and until he became famous because of the publication of his prophecies.
When did he begin to write the prophecies, and what then happened to him? And again, I keep going back to happened to him. I mean, something gave him this gift.
We'll never be able to, well, at least I don't think I can answer the last question. The first questions are much easier to answer. He began writing Bucatrins round about, well, in the 1540s, and he published the first of his collection of what were called prophéties, a collection of quatrains, in 1555. And this was followed by a second volume 2 years later. There are many attempts have been made to try and find out how he arrived at these prophecies, and they've all, in a sense, been foredoomed to failure. There is absolutely, absolutely no doubt whatsoever that he could see into the future, and that he, in his guarded way, for reasons which I've already set out,
he protected himself.
He protected himself, and yet it is possible, with quite a deal of effort and with some knowledge of the languages in which he wrote, to work out what these prophecies were. That's really what I've occupied myself with over the past few years.
Well, when you say he wrote these in a book, though, was he sharing them with everyone?
He was publishing them. From about 1555 onwards, he did two forms of publication. He brought out two different types of books. One was an annual ephemeris, or what he called a prognostication. That is, a prognostication for the year, in which there were 12, sometimes 13 verses, four-line verses, one for each month of that year.
Was he like the Farmer's Almanac that we have in the United States?
Yes, a bit like that, except a little more sophisticated, because in addition to bringing out these 12 predictions for the year, that is, each relating to the month, some event that would take place in that month, he also gave a prediction for every single day in that year.
My.
So that at the end of, well, he published these things for well over 10 years. So, he made thousands and thousands of prophecies, of course. And quite a few of them I have Czech managed to determine what they were. It's very, very hard, of course, to go back to events on a day-to-day basis. But some of them were sufficiently famous for me to have been able to resurrect what they were.
Tell us a few of those that occurred then.
Well, he was particularly interested, of course, in local wars, in events that affected the reigning king. He became very interested, I think probably when he went to the court of France, he might well have met the young Mary Queen of Scots, and he became very interested in her destiny, her several marriages and her very unfortunate life. And some of his day-to-day prophecies relate to events in her life, you know, her marriages and things like that.
Did the people of the era all know him at that time, David?
He became very famous in the 50s, in the mid-50s, that is 1550s, of course, because of the prognostications, not because of his quatrains, the things that we now think of him as being famous. We have to imagine that if you have somebody who is publishing quatrains on a day-to-day or on a month-to-month basis, you have this feeling of contemporary success. You know, you're terribly interested
right.
in what's happening around you. We have lost that feeling for the prognostications, and there's very little interest shown in them nowadays because it means that you have to kind of put yourself back almost 500 years. Very, very hard to do. We are much more interested in those quatrains which perhaps pertain to ourselves or which pertain to very famous events in history.
And he was either right or wrong, and they probably all knew about it then.
Well, certainly one or two of his prophecies were so clearly correct that he became famous more or less overnight. The major problem was that the languages in which he wrote did tend to put people off. Even his contemporaries, you know, said, well, all this is a lot of rubbish because it's not even good French.
It was hard to understand then. It is now, at least for me.
Yes. Well, he wrote in... You see, most people think that he wrote his verses in French, but that is not true at all. He wrote essentially in French, but it was French framed in a Latinate style, and he intermixed the French words with Latin, Greek, and Provençal, and sometimes, because he could read both Hebrew and Italian very well, read and write those two languages, he sometimes introduced ideas and words and numerologies from both Hebrew and Italian. So they're very, very complex verses.
When he wrote, do we know if he was in a certain trance or state of mind?
Well, we don't know. Now, as I say, we know very little about how he wrote. I would think he wasn't in a trance in any sense, because one of the techniques he used, well, first of all, he used astrology to give dates to some of his quatrains, and of course you can't do astrology in a trance. It's a mathematical enterprise. Secondly, he very frequently used obscure quotations from texts to give meaning to his verses, and you can only work out this meaning if you become familiar with the texts. Perhaps I should give an example.
Okay, here. Sure, please.
I was rather hoping that at some point we'd be able to talk about quatrain in book two, number 41 in book two. We've got a choice. I could either read it out to you in French, or I could translate it as I go along.
Translate it if you can.
Sure
we have many French.
It makes it more difficult, not because it's difficult for me to translate it, but it's difficult to explain the meanings. He's in this quatrain. He's talking about. He's making a wonderful prediction. It's, to my mind, one of the great predictions of his whole cycle. It's about the prediction of the Nova, the new star, which appeared in 1572.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this was a very important event, although we've tended to forget how important it was, because until 1572, scientists and astronomers and astrologers believed that the skies themselves were perfect and were not subject to change, in contrast with the Earth itself, which is obviously very mutable and subject to change. So the heavens were very different from the earth. But then suddenly, in 1572, this new star appeared near Cassiopeia, and it had a profound effect on men's thinking, because suddenly they realized that even the heavens were not sacrosanct, that even the heavens were subject to this mutability. And Nostradamus, writing in 1552, that is almost 20 years before it occurred, was tried to set down its importance. And in the first three lines of this quatrain, he describes a star, this new star, locates it in the skies, and then in the fourth line he uses a technique which is very familiar to him, that is, he dated it by reference to a particular event. So if I go through it line by line, forgive me if it sounds terribly obscure, but these are the lines. The great star will burn for 7 days. From the darkness it will appear as though there were two suns. The great dog will bark all night when the great pontiff changes the territory. Now, the problem is, in translating it, I'm losing some of the double meanings. For example, in the last line, when I say, when the great pontiff will change his territory, he uses the word terroir. Now, terroir does mean territory in French, but it also means terror. So you have this idea of the pontiff, that is the Pope, changing both the terror and the territory. I'll come back to the meaning of that shortly. I just want to go back to our original theme. I was saying that very often he would quote, and unless you knew what the quotation was, unless you could identify the text from which he'd taken this quotation, the line didn't have all that much sense, doesn't make all that much sense. But here, where I was talking about the what he calls le gros mastin, the great dog will bark, or... Yes, bark all night.
It sounds like a constellation to me.
Well, it is. It's not a constellation. It's actually, it is really, I suppose. It's the star Sirius. And the quotation is from a shepherd's calendar published before Nostradamus wrote. And the actual translation is, the dog whose baleful barking brings in plagues and dreary death. So he's actually quoting from that in his third line. And in quoting in this way, he's referring to the dog star. And so, to try and make sense of the whole thing, he's dealing with the Nova of 1572, one of the great wonders of his age. He's mentioning that it looks like a second sun. Now, of course, if there were a second sun in the skies, our whole cosmos would come to an end. And it was quite possible, if you didn't understand what the literary background to that was, that you might imagine that he was predicting a time when there would be two suns.
Right, right.
And the whole thing, the whole world would be thrown into chaos. There would be instant destruction. But in fact, he's referring to a text written around about the time Christ came to earth, called the Astronomica of Manilius, a poem, in which Manilius developed this notion that Sirius itself was a second sun in the skies, a distant sun.
See, he must have been so well read in order to pull these different little lines and these scriptures from different books.
Oh, indeed, yes, he was amazingly well read in very many languages. And this is half the problem in trying to, you know, work out his quatrain. Not all the quatrains have all this inbuilt literary references. I've just happened to choose one which has. Then to come to the secret of this verse, which is the final line, which I said was when the great pope or pontiff changes the terror or the territory.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is actually a reference to one of the greatest popes of the century, Gregory the 13th. And he came, when Pius the 5th died, Gregory came to the throne of Rome. And that was in 1572. That is in precisely the year of the Nova.
Yeah.
And of course, you've got to remember that Nostradamus was writing this 20 years earlier. Now, Gregory was really responsible for some very important changes For example, in the calendar, we still call our calendar the Gregorian calendar because it was Gregory who put the changes necessary for the change of calendar into effect. Now, what Nostradamus is doing is pointing to changes that occurred in the year following the election of Gregory the 13th. Gregory had been trying to persuade Spain and Venice to fight against the Turks, who were the scourge of the Mediterranean.
All right, stay with us, David. We're going to take this quick commercial break, okay? And we'll be right back with you with our guest David Overson as we talk about Nostradamus and how, because we're building up to this, how it affects us here in the United States. Back in a moment.
Find out more about tonight's guest. Log on to coasttocoastam.com. Networks presents Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie.
Well, we're going to continue our interview with David Overson as we talk about the prophecies of Nostradamus right here on Coast to Coast AM. Well, Japan, by the way, has just issued a tsunami warning after a 6.8 magnitude earthquake struck off its eastern coast. No immediate reports of damage or injuries. Nostradamus predicted a lot of natural catastrophes. David, we'll talk about that later on tonight. But he was pretty prophetic when it came to that, wasn't he?
I'm not sure about natural catastrophes. He did use the imagery of natural catastrophes, like volcanoes and high winds and so on, but they were really, he was much more interested in personifications. They were usually meant to represent mutations in society rather than natural catastrophes.
We were talking before the break about his prophecies of the Nova.
Yes,
and the Pope Gregory, by the way.
Yes. We'd reached a point where I was saying that Gregory, who is used in the final line as a convenient personality on which he can hang the future date, because Gregory came to the papal throne in 1572. Now, it was Gregory who, in this particular quatrain, he is said to be the great pontiff who will change the territory or the terror, because terroir in French has this double meaning. In fact, when he did come to the throne, he wanted to fight the Turks, the Turks who were actually dominating the Mediterranean and indeed threatening Europe at that time. And so he attempted to persuade both the great armies of Spain and Venice, that powerful island state as it was then, to fight on his behalf against the Turks. But they refused to do this. And so he turned his attention away from fighting Islamic Turkey to fighting, this is unbelievable, he was a pope, to fighting Christian Europe. He took measures to help the Catholic League in France against the Protestants, and then he lent financial and moral support to Philip II of Spain in his wars against the Protestants in the Netherlands. And this is why Nostradamus said he would change his territory, that is, he changed away from Turkey to Europe, and also the terror, because, of course, his fight against the Netherlands was absolutely horrific, bloodthirsty, and cruel. So just as the Nova changed man's vision of the cosmos, so the Pope changed his own domain and looked no longer to the threat of Islam, but to this threat of internal Christian schism. And he changed the vision of what Protestantism was.
What other prophecies, David, was Nostradamus pretty accurate with during that?
Well, so many that it's I could give you a list of, say, 10
okay.
random ones, but
sure.
I know of at least 300 in which he was as precisely accurate as the example I've just given you. If I were to run through 10 in sequence, starting in the 16th century and coming up to the 20th century, it might interest you.
Okay.
He predicted, famously, the death of Henry II in 1558. This was in Quatrain 135. It was a particularly dramatic death because Henry was killed in a joust when a splinter of a lance went into his eye and, of course, blinded him and left him in agony for 11 days. And each of these details is described in that quatrain. He then
Did he try to warn the king?
No, he didn't. But actually, another astrologer called Luke Goriacus did try to warn the king, but the king laughed off this warning because he said, you know, I'm in Nostradamus's phrase, he was to be killed in a joust, and of course that was interpreted as being a military joust, but as it was just a kind of a ceremonial joust. But the king said, well, you know, I'm a king, and so I'm not going to fight in a joust. Which was absolutely the case. He wouldn't have fought in a joust, but He didn't equate being a ceremonial joust with a military joust.
Yeah.
And so he laughed it off and said, you know, it's a silly prophecy. The Battle of Lepanto, that was the second most astonishing prediction made by Nostradamus. That was Quatrain 2, number 5 in Book 2. That occurred in 1571. The Nova I've already dealt with,
mm-hmm.
I shall not link that. The next really quite interesting one was the coming of the Spanish Armada in 1588. That was in Book 1, number 19. Then, just to leap a century, he predicted the, very famously again, the execution of Charles I in 1649. That was in Book 8, number 37. And at the same time, although in a different book, he predicted the Great Fire of London in 1666. This is one of the rare verses in which he actually dates the event. He offers a date in, although he doesn't say 1666, he says 666, which
that's,
of course,
yeah,
is a famous arcane number.
Ominous, yeah.
Yes. But the interesting thing about those two prophecies, the execution of Charles and the Great Fire of London, is that they were immediately recognized by contemporaries for what they were. People recognized these quotations, these quatrains, and books that were published in the following year kept referring to these two Nostradamian prophecies. And I have a collection of Nostradamus books, of course, and I've got some wonderful 17th century examples, and one of the most famous was produced in 1668, and that has an engraving, an engraved title page, and these two prophecies, the execution of Charles and the Great Fire of London, figure in images on the front, on the title page, because they were so famous, but
mm-hmm.
instantly famous. Then in 1765, or for 1765, he predicted the loss of the American colonies. A little later, I'll talk specifically about the American prophecies.
Sure.
But that's quite an interesting one because, of course, it involved both Britain and America, both of which he talks about in this quatrain in Book 6.
And again, he's writing in 1555, right around that period.
Sure. One tends to forget, actually. You always have a feeling
that he's still there.
Contemporary reporter.
Yeah,
He, 1793, he had two obsessions, actually. One obsession was with the French Revolution, the terror of the French Revolution.
Right.
And he wrote maybe 20 quatrains or verses about the French Revolution, two of which are astonishing, one of which is among my favorites. But Book 9, 77, he wrote about the beheading of Louis the 16th and Marie Antoinette, his wife. But maybe if we've time later, I can discuss some of the other prophecies he
sure.
made about Louis. Because it was for him, it was almost inconceivable for a man who was a staunch royalist and indeed a friend of the King of France in the 16th century that the French would actually execute their own king. And so, for him, it was the dark spot in French history.
Yet he saw that.
Yes. Oh, yes, yes. Then, in 1878, he predicted in a rather delightful quatrain the doctrine of papal infallibility, which he again regarded as an absurdity. Then a very interesting, very closely after, he made a prediction for the first successful flight. There were actually three or four verses in which he discusses flight. And the first one deals with balloon flight. The second deals with aerial flight, actually the flights which took place near the Smithsonian in Washington, D.C.
Was he pretty accurate?
Oh, absolutely accurate. I mean, let me give you an example of that.
Okay.
The problem is I talk not knowing quite how much time we have, but let's just talk.
I've got you for 3 hours, David.
3 hours. I'll probably run out of talk then. However, let's consider this first successful flight of 1783. This was predicted in Book 8, in verse 53. I give these references in case anyone is sufficiently interested to follow up my suggestions. In this, there's a famous line, which again I'll translate. It says, inside Boulogne, he would wash away his faults. Now, of course, in a sense, that's almost meaningless. We don't know who he is. We don't know which Boulogne he's talking about. There's several Boulognes in Europe. And what is washing away his faults? Well, the quatrain actually refers to an event in 1783, which was the first manned balloon flight. A Frenchman called Pilâtre de Rosière made this flight. And then shortly afterwards, well, actually 2 years later, he made an attempt to fly by balloon across the English Channel, or as the French would call it, the French Channel. And he died. That was in 1785. He crashed and was killed. Now, this flight was actually from the Bois de Boulogne. And Nostradamus had mentioned Boulogne, of course, in that line. And Nostradamus had then said, inside Boulogne, he would wash away his faults. Well, here you have a direct reference to Pilate. His name was Pilâtre, which translates as Pilate de Rosière, and it's Pilate who washes his hands when he's called upon to condemn Christ.
Amazing.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's his technique. It's always a second hidden meaning, and
like
usually a literary reference. You know.
He wrote the way Jesus would talk in those parables, almost, where you had to really search for the meaning.
Absolutely.
What was your favorite prophecy? You had just mentioned that you had a favorite one.
Well, actually, my favorite, I've already discussed to some extent, which is the Nova.
The Nova was? Okay, that was yours.
There are others. I mean, I'm very fond of the prophecy which Nostradamus made about the flight, the so-called flight to Varennes of Louis and Marie Antoinette in 1791. I'm fond of it for lots of reasons, and it almost brings me back to an American theme. Nostradamus saw this flight. Well, I better tell you what the flight was first of all. I call it the so-called flight to Varennes because Louis and Marie Antoinette had fearful, and quite rightly so, that they were going to be taken by the French revolutionaries and perhaps shot or hanged or beheaded, decided to leave Paris. And someone, a friend of theirs, who in fact was also a friend of George Washington, unbelievably, helped them to escape, and he arranged for them to meet him a few miles from Varennes in the north east of France, where he could then convey them, where he would have a military guard waiting for them.
Where were they going to go, David, once they
Well, they were going to go to Belgium.
Okay.
Where they would have the protection of the of what is, well, what is now called Belgium, of course. They would have the protection of the German army. And also, the people who had escaped from France, particularly the aristocrats, who were anxious to see the king remain on the throne, but who recognized he needed protection. So there was a kind of a French army of resistance that would help him once he managed to escape. So the escape, very, very carefully planned, went very well until they reached Varennes. Historians have later discovered that there was a spy in the service of Marie Antoinette, and so everything was actually known to the French revolutionaries.
But they
didn't know this at the time. In fact, very few contemporaries knew this. But it was clear that Nostradamus was aware of what was going on. Now, the interesting thing, and I don't particularly want to discuss this quatrain in great detail because it's almost too complex without we have the text in front of us.
Right,
but
I understand.
One point I would like to make is this, that all along, Nostradamus refers, he actually uses the word Varennes, he refers to this village, small village, where Marie Antoinette and Louis were arrested and then returned back to Paris and eventually beheaded. But the interesting thing about this is, whilst Nostradamus mentions Varennes by name, in his day, that is in 1555, it wasn't called Varennes.
What was it called?
It was called Varniennes. Yet he used the modern spelling.
I'll see.
And I couldn't believe this. You know,
when
it began to dawn on me, I decided that as one of the people who had helped them escape, and his name has just slipped the tip of my tongue for a minute.
It wasn't Lafitte.
I'm desperately trying to remember. Hang on. Yes, Fersen. Alex Fersen, who was he was in charge of one of the guards regiments although he's Swedish, in France, in Paris, and he'd been sent to help the French cause in America in the war, in the American War of when they rebelled against the dreadful Brits.
Right.
And Fersen knew George Washington reasonably well, and because of this I thought to myself, well, if there are any maps of that period when Marie Antoinette and Louis were escaping, they're bound to be somewhere in France. America. And it turned out that they have copies in the Library of Congress, in the specialist map collection. So when I found these maps and located Varennes, I realized that it was exactly the same village which is later in modern times called Varennes.
Yeah, that's something.
I know, it kind of made me go, although I've been dealing with Nostradamus for years and years, it made me go cold.
Yes, well, when you start seeing the accuracy of his predictions, then you begin to wonder about those that we'll talk about next hour, which would lead us into some American predictions. Because, and here's my big question for you tonight, David, and a lot will be, I think, interpretation, and you're very good at this. I've talked to a lot of people who have studied Nostradamus, and you have just fantastic interpretations, and you explain it well and in detail. But if one assumes that most of his predictions were true, then you have to assume that the ones about the future, that which has not happened yet, probably is also true. Isn't that correct?
Well, yes, I think that is an absolutely reasonable argument. Indeed, I tend to think that if you can't solve the conundrum of a particular quatrain, then it probably is not an inaccurate or misleading quatrain. I think it will relate to the future.
I want to talk next hour about the Antichrist. There are some who would like to know if Mahmoud Abbas, the new Palestinian leader, might be the Antichrist because of the quatrain that talks about Mabus. The remarkable correlation between...
Oh, Mabus.
Mabus. The remarkable correlation between, what was it, Hister and Hitler as a possible Antichrist, Napoleon as well, lots more that we'll talk about. As you look at this, was he an astrologer, David?
Well, he was indeed. I mean, he was one of the greatest astrologers of the 16th century. And this has only fairly recently been confirmed in this, in that some of his, or copies of some of his horoscopes and readings surfaced in a library in France, and they've only really recently been translated from the Latin into the French. It's best probably not to say too much on the radio, but they're not particularly good translations, unfortunately, so one has to stick with the Latin at the moment.
All right, stay with us. We'll be back with David Ovesen later on tonight. We'll open up the phone lines, let you have an opportunity to chat with him as well. You might remember David was with me on December 17th, as we talked about the secret symbols of the dollar bill, where he gave us his interpretations of the bill, the dollar bill, and that was fascinating too. I'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM.
Get it in writing with the After Dark newsletter. Subscribe by calling 1-888-727-5505.